Mr. Whittaker, Reel 15. You were telling me about the events of the morning of the 21st of November during the breakout when you were working with the Black Watch.
Yes.
Or connected to.
Yes. During all this excitement and after, say, when the Black Watch had lost communications, Dennis Middleton, the signal sergeant, did come through and tell me that the brigade were on our frequency. And I don't know whether he was telling me to watch what I said, but the chief thing was, he was telling me was that if the colonel, if the Black Watch wanted any message of the past, brigade would be listening into, which would save an awful lot of time. And one after this unfortunate episode where they veered off course and took an extra strong point, the only messages I can recall, although I must admit I talked all morning, was the colonel came and said, tell them I've lost 60% of my chaps and I want reinforcements as soon as possible. So I had a code book, and I can always remember them, but one bit of the code book was that reserves were pigeons, and I've forgotten one, but I know I coded it, just said, and you had codes for figures, and I know the message just said something like 60% casualties, you know, I reduced whatever he told me to just brief, you know, 60% casualties, what was it, need urgent pigeons, and they were astonished when, within an incredibly short space of time, this regiment who'd been held in reserve and was going to go on to it, came over the, literally, this it was downstroke, and came over the hill. And I could run the curve, you know, so I said, how the hell did they get here? And I said, brigade listening to us, and presumably they've sent them. But of course it made all the difference, because he would have kept him up to strength.
Were you under much fire yourself?
Amount of fire.
What was it?
All sorts of stuff. Mostly German, as distinct from the Italian 75. This was dangerous. This was 105 millimeter. You could tell because occasionally you'd get a ricochet. Which did happen, by the way, they fired on a very low trajectory, and sometimes they hit the ground and ricochet. But then, and as I say, there were bits of things hitting the carrier. Prisoners began to come back wearing the old German helmets. When I stuck my head up over the side and said, "Oh, Germans." Major Birkin corrected me, he says, it's Italian battalions that are holding this, and they've got German helmet. They were Germans to me. They'd actually got the old one, first I'd ever seen, you know, the square. So they must have been Germans. I'll have them to this day, they were, whatever they were, they've got the right helmet. As I was saying, so it went on. And eventually, occasionally, we caught up with, or he'd catch up with us, Stan Keaton in his truck, and all boats they were still shouting and waving to us, reeling this line out in the middle of all this lot. Forget how many men he'd got, but there were also, the lines were getting broken as fast as they did, but of course there was still the old tank and Bren carriers backwards and forwards, and occasional trucks picking up wounded. You know, they're beginning to pick up the wounded. But eventually, as I say, our chap in front, Hobbo, as we call it, heard our gun firing a bit. Major Birkin went down on his face once, which horrified me. I should have mentioned, just as we'd started out, he said to me, "All right, Whittaker," he says, "if anything happens to me, this is your show." He said, "Graham Slim will give you any help." He said, but he'll probably be busy on his own. So I said, you know what to do. I can remember to this day, my stomach, oh, here, I don't know.
You mean he fell over?
He fell over. I don't know what it was, but I know he stumbled and fell. I can remember their eyes, but he got up again. Eventually, we arrived at this so-called strong point, which is the most miserable little selection of holes and things you've ever seen.
Would that be Tiger?
It's Tiger. We reported we were there, and after we got there, for a bit it was really hot. The noise had died down to then because we'd finished. We'd had to alter the barrage, of course. You know, it had all run late, and we'd set fire phase 3 again, and all this sort of thing. And they'd asked us for extra fire on various points. These were the sort of messages I was passing. Mostly it was fixed targets, so I didn't have to give any ranges or anything. You could say Butch plus 200 or whatever. You know, Major Birkin could give me the things, and that was it. Everybody was on the ball, you know, you didn't have to go through all the ring at all. When we got on this tyre, for a bit, they really blasted us. They fired 9 of these things, as I said, on ricochet, and I found out afterwards it's quite a deliberate tactic. And these things, some of these things were about a yard long, and they'd turn, and they made the most horrible noise. Woof, 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 woof. Just over your head. Then one would bounce. And they'd make, you know, real. The noise was more frightening than things, because unless they hit on the nose, they're not going to explode. The only thing was, if anybody kicked them on the nose, they'd come off. And the other thing, they shot at us with the 88mm, which was the Germans' favourite weapon.
Was that the first time you'd come across the 88?
First time I'd really come. And these, they were firing at close range. And I found after the first few shots when everybody's expression was, you know, Christ almighty, what's that? And there were two bangs. And the second one you heard was the gun going off. It fired so fast that it, I think it was almost supersonic, but it didn't fly ever so close. So with enormous, you'd find a big bang there that was a shell burst close to you. And then you hear, you put your head down and go for the next bang. But that was safe. As somebody said after a few, said, oh, well, if you hear the second bang, you're still alive. They were still full, you know, people were still full of, I think it was to hide everyone were feeling. But it was, I don't know how long that was, but they really, you know, well, I think they realised we'd come to a standstill, and for a bit, it died down after a bit, and was occasional shots. What I should have mentioned, as we arrived at Tiger, there was Bombardier Keaton with his wireline truck. Actually, he got there before us, and he, with, you know, really, just to show how cool he was, where do you want the telephone served? He got the military medal when Stan Keaton for his exploits. It worked straight away. We got this phone and put it on, but it was broken. It was constantly being cut for the first, well, all the time I was there. This, I know it was, to us it was lunchtime, and we did brew up. The colonel, one thing did shake me to the core, the Black Watch, began to sort themselves out. The regimental sergeant major was close to us, and he shouted across to a sergeant, "Sergeant, so-and-so, do something." And the sergeant said, "But sir," and immediately the regimental sergeant major screamed at him, "But you're on an effing charge." They got two sergeants to put this sergeant on a charge, put him under threat. So that meant three sergeants were out of action. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. but that was my own...
Were they a regular unit?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Was it the first or the second battalion? We'll look it up.
But, oh yes, they were very much regular. The discipline, that was the discipline. Mind you, whether they are, I suppose they needed, these were walking, we were only guns. But I thought, well, how ridiculous, they've lost all these men, and there was this three men out of action. But anyway, we sort of got settled, found a hole, as I said, and then we got our telephone, and we started to brew up and have a drink and look around. I did check after a bit, and I found that I'd lost my great coat. The straps on the thing were cut clean in two. The straps were still there, and they were cut. So that was must have been something fairly close. There were a lot of bits marked on the coat, but otherwise, as I say, it. And so we settled down, had something to got to contact everybody else. I did get one message just after we'd got there, where a voice did tell me that it was Brigade HQ and said, report your position. And I was very proud. They said, whatever our number was, Tiger, repeat Tiger. And the voice said, thank you. The other thing I can remember about the sort of finish of this episode was the colonel was coming over to Major Burke and said, thanks, Peter, and strolled off. And I think it maybe started then, but I always thought he should have said thank you to me. I always had this vague impression, because I can remember the other thing, my head was absolutely burning. I've been talking now, but that morning I talked for hours on end, because they said, there were constant messages and we were what was happening, I was practically giving them a running commentary. But of course, what I didn't know was that 425 HQ Brigade were asking them questions, and of course we were being passed on to us. Fantastic morning.
Were you scared?
Didn't have time. Literally didn't have. The only time, as I say, when I felt was when I was reminded of what I'd have to do if the Major got hit and when he went down. And that was it. Otherwise, I just didn't have time to feel anything. It was just talking and, just doing the job.
So you consolidated your position on the Tiger post.
Yeah.
That would be early afternoon.
It was lunchtime or whatever.
What happened for the rest of that day?
Well, in the afternoon, we got a big... The main thing, we got a big flap on. There was a counter-attack came in from Strong Point, which was a bit further away, and to the east, Wharf. You could see quite clearly without binoculars. I should have mentioned one of the proud things was being an OPAC and you've got a compass and a pair of binoculars. I think that was a big attraction, things to have on your belt. But you could see these with the naked eye. Vehicles, Italian tanks, not Germans, tinplate things. And we had a real good shoot on them, which they came forward a bit, but they soon turned tail and hopped it. The other thing I should have mentioned, during the morning, the one thing we dreaded, during the time we were going forward, all of a sudden, while I was on the radio, big hammer on the back, our signal, there the bastards are, here they come, there's this aircraft, and of course, with the Air Force, of course, were very much the underdogs, and looked up and to our delight, he was fairly low, and he'd got big red, white, and blue roundels on. And he was one of the. This was the first I'd seen of the kitty hawks with the big sharks, the painted sharks' teeth on them. And he sailed over, but I can tell you the relief there, that was enormous. The other aeroplane I saw in the morning was a Messerschmitt, which before I'd taken over, they forced landed in between the two lines, out to the east, came down like a bomb, and as he came in, and at the last minute, levelled, went along like a bullet. Now, swear to this day, the pilot was out and running. It just looked as if he'd got out. I don't know how he could have passed the wing, but still, it looked. The other amazing thing, a friend of mine, I did ask her about this, and the next morning it had gone. They picked it up. They must have been picking up casualties, vehicles or any form of thing that is out. They picked them up like a shot, much better than us at it. But say that was the. Then the counter attack in the afternoon. And then it was after that, the members were a bit hated. We were, I know we spent the night there another day or two. The following day, we had another one of Peter Birkin's exploits.
What was that?
Another counter attack. Was this another thing? And we'd gone forward. And the remaining Matildas, the eye tanks, had come up. And in order to see, we got news of this attack, but where we were, we couldn't really see it. And the Major actually stood right on top of the, he actually stood on top of the turret and shouted fire orders down to us. But he stood there, bold as brass up on top of this tank and shouted fire orders. Most amazing. Mind you, Peter, he always wanted to prove himself. He'd have loved to have got some medals or whatever, and I don't think he ever did. No hesitation getting up when he couldn't see, and from there he got a good view and shouted fire orders down to us. We put the carrier up alongside the tank on the right side of it, I might tell you too. And as I say, that was we spent a few days out there, doing shooting. Captain Slim one night or evening, they found a troop, four German 105mm deserted, and we tried to fetch them in. And they, when they went out, our gun turret, of course, we would pull one of these guns, so they took two out. We took one in, which everybody was delighted. The first German gun that had been captured in the Middle East. Huge thing, solid tyres. When they went back for the rest, they're gone. Once again. And our people were, they must have been as close as, nobody had seen or heard anything, not according to them, but they'd gone. So we got one out of these. Well, I said they were very good at picking up stuff. But the rest, after that, we went back after some days. We went back to the command post. There was no battery HQ as such. We took up our place near the command post, and I ran messages to and from, and occasionally we went out. I went out on my own once or twice, which pleased me immensely with the carrier, just that I never got a chance to be liaising with the troop commanders who'd taken over. But it was 426 battery who took the brunt of the action after that. They'd taken their guns right outside the wire, and there was a lot of shelling. We had one, we got involved in shooting on one of these attacks, where, most amazing, they got another of these brilliant orders down. Fire like hell till I tell you to stop. And that was to the end. They fired. I was actually with, as I say, we were at the command post. and now go to the fire, they would say, you know, what's going on, we have to get that fire. But an Australian with us, a seaman, in a really interesting man, you ask him, he knew every pub. People you'd meet, and people used to try and catch him out. Speak to a South African, you know, and he'd say, do you know the pub in Durban? Oh, such and such a street. And he was with us. He'd come to us before he went up to the brook. He'd been a seaman. He'd landed in England when the war was on and decided he couldn't wait for the Australians. So he joined up and got in the artillery and got closer to us. But he distinguished himself. He loaded literally hundreds of rounds that afternoon, which is known, you know, these weigh 25 pounds a tonne. And all afternoon, bang, 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 and taking care the number one doesn't knock your thumbs off. The only thing was, at the end of the afternoon, one of my colleagues, one who had joined me, Les Marsh, and his gun blew up. It was so hot that they loaded it. Just as they got the orders to... I think the orders stopped firing. They have these orders now. Cease firing, I think you load and then stop. They said stop firing, you don't load. Anyway, they got the one down with the shell up the breech and then stop. And they put the shell up and the shell exploded premature. And of course, with the breech open, and I had two guns going in these enormous bands. I ran over and one chap got killed, there were certainly several wounded. It was a real chaos, most unfortunate. From then on, it was, until the famous day, it was all a real mix-up as far as I was concerned. I did distinguish myself. I got a touch of jaundice. I woke up one morning, felt horrible, my eyes were yellow. And the major said to me, can you carry on? And I said, well, I think so. He said, and the first one took me down to the medical officer. He said, can you give him something, put him right? He said, I want him for a couple of days. I don't want him to give me a huge dose of castor oil. I sat on the thunderbox for hours. But anyway, the next week, we went out doing, this was when they wanted extra peers. We did do some shooting, where what they did, we just had, in order to keep sort of just the driver, the basically yourself, just three of us. He didn't want to put anybody else in any, danger. And he said, stick it out. He said, I'll see you right when it's all over. And I did. And I felt awful. But, you know, I could still say, you know, it was 10,000 or whatever, two. I always said 10,000. I think the maximum was about 8. But that was it. Then, of course, the great day, there was all these tank battles then with, as I say, tremendous stuff up on the famous Sidi Rezeg at Dudar, which was coming to us second hand. 426, I say, were taking an awful hammering. We did go out on one of these occasions, very far forward, just under the shadow of the escarpment, and we arrived there to do this shoot on something. Before we could start firing, there was a huge convoy going along, you could see them along the top of the escarpment. And the hurricanes came down with them, and I felt sorry for the joke there. First I'd ever seen the hurricanes, they carried bombs, they got cannon, the first aircraft I'd ever seen with cannon. One went along them with bombs, and the second then turned around and back with these, with cannons and with machine guns. We went along that road afterwards, and it was absolute, the vehicles were still, and they blasted hell out of them, so we didn't have to shoot. But then eventually, as I say, it was as far as I was concerned, I can't remember, it was all out, shoot, back again, do whatever I was told, and as I say, a lot of running messages where various things wanted me to deliver things by hand to various people. And eventually came the great day when local one of the New Zealanders had come in to relieve. After they left us, we all shook hands and clapped them on the back, and the Rotten Devils had relieved me, certainly. Everything I'd got, the camera, which I wasn't supposed to have, which I'd got, I've got the reaming that I've taken up there, my power, my watch, my money. I've been able to leave it up there just in a hole, you know, you made a bit of a shelf, my wallet. I'd left everything, never bothered there from April till, what was it, mid-end, December, the end of November. Never lost them, nobody never touched a thing. And these, who were supposed, New Zealand's all had a reputation of being honest, good-hearted people. Everything I'd left was gone when I was going to my slip trench that I, my little hole I'd made and covered in. And, that was it. That was the end as far as I was concerned. The siege of Tobruk was at an end.
So what happened next then?
We eventually, after there was still, although the New Zealand got there, there was still fighting. These tank battles continued for some time upon the ridge, this carpet. But eventually the Germans fell back and we went out. We got home back and out and we had a look at these places that we'd fired at through the old deserted village, the back of Bir Aziz, this well, our famous dummy pole. Went on and had a look at the sangers where the blanket shakers had been. And we wandered, literally wandered up the desert with no... I don't think anybody knew what to do with us. We finished up, we stayed a few nights in some caves at Derna, where I lost every cartoon. We finished up about Christmas.
How come you lost your cartoons?
Well, they used to pass them round, and somebody took them to have a look at them. And when they didn't pass them back, I said, "Who's got them?" And there were only a few of us in this particular, and we couldn't find them. Everybody turned the stuff out, and they literally couldn't find these things. Pile an inch thick, cardboard covers with the name on and everything. Please return to. Never did find them. Anyway, we went off, as I say, doing apparently nothing, really quite aimless, a real farce. And we finished up about Christmas time at a place called Tamimi. There were some marshes there, and the only trouble was we were on nobody's ration strength, and food was beginning to get as short as it was in Tobruk. Peter Birkin had a shotgun. I had acquired, this time, a Tommy gun.
Where'd you got that from?
Well, it had been another friend of mine had picked it up on the going down where the Black Horse had been and found it lying there. And it shot .45 ammunition. And from a friendly tank commander, he gave me a kit bag full of .45 ammunition. And the only thing was, when I acquired it, it had only fit. And it was the real thing, this was the real gangsters with the round magazine and the pistol grip. The later ones had a flat grip and straight magazines. The only thing was, you fired it and it wouldn't stop. It fired the whole 50 straight off. But being a mechanical genius with them, we took it to pieces and we found a spring from the Bren gun spares and fitted it in. Anyway, Peter had this shotgun, and to try and supplement the rations, on these marshes there were ducks. So we took the 800 weight thing, and I didn't dare fire the Tommy gun there, but I did score a notable success. I shot this bird at a quite good distance, and for me I was never a good shot, and I had to wade to get it, course, Major Birkin was wading through these marshes trying to put ducks up. But I shot this sitting thing, and when I got it was a coot, and I found you couldn't eat coot. And also, I was told I was absolutely no gentleman, because you just don't shoot sitting birds. It would never be. We set off on our own after he put us up. And I did take the Tommy gun, and when you fired that, if you've ever seen duck frightened ducks, it was all good fun, but it didn't supplement rations. But about Christmas, they did manage to